On this episode of the podcast, Todd sits down with Brandon Heavey and Nicole Latimer from Evidence-Based Athlete.
Hey guys, this is Todd from South Loop Strength and Conditioning, and I'm chatting today with Brandon Heavey and Nicole Latimer from Evidence-Based Athlete. Brandon and Nicole and I were actually at the Ancestral Health Symposium a few weeks ago in Boulder, which was neat and a good time for everyone involved, I think, checking out some lectures on various topics involving vitamin and mineral metabolism, obesity, mismatches between the current environment and our genetics and all that type of stuff. So we had some good lectures that we took in and ate at some reasonable restaurants in Boulder throughout that process. So I figured we'd start and kind of just go through, you know, what you guys took away from that symposium. Then we can start kind of getting into some more details in terms of what your process looks like for Evidence-Based Athlete, how you guys deal with different issues that you encounter with, you know, performance-based clients and health-based clients and all that type of stuff. So how are you guys today? How are you guys feeling?
Doing great.
Yeah.
Doing good.
What about, what did you guys take away from that symposium? What were your favorite lectures or things that you actually, you know, said, okay, this is going to change the way that I approach dealing with clients or my own health and fitness?
I personally liked the, there were two talks that kind of stood out for me. And the first was Chris Masterjohn's talk on fat soluble vitamins and sex hormones.
Yeah, I agree.
And, the second one, Tim Gersmart, the obesogens talk and, endocrine disrupting chemicals. And I think, you know, for me, the reason that those two kind of stood out was we work with a lot of people on, hormone imbalances, in our business. And so to get those expert, you know, insights in those areas of chemical disruptions and the way that vitamins affect sex hormone pathways was really interesting.
Sure. What about you, Nicole?
I'd say my favorite was also the obesogens, just because, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years before moving out to Colorado, I was a diabetes pharmacist. So I worked with a lot of patients that were severely overweight, and no matter what they did, they couldn't drop the weight. So I thought that was a really interesting talk, you know, going back on my experience from that. And then I also really liked the talk from Daryl Edwards. And I don't think you or Brandon were at that one.
Yeah, I missed that one.
Yeah, but he's a guy, he's actually from the UK, and he has a website, primalplay.com. And it's all about like making fitness fun. So he actually, you know, had us play games with the people around us next to us. And, you know, we got out of breath, you know, even though we were just like standing up next to our chairs and, you know, like playing fencing or tag or tug of war with people. And, you know, I think that's really important for people to get back to their roots of like, you know, just because you're an adult doesn't mean you can't play anymore. So I really like that one too.
Yeah. You know what? I actually hate fun. So I think I'm glad that I'm glad that I missed that one.
I think that that's a valid point though. You know, we kind of get all caught up in this sort of strength and condition and CrossFit-y world in sets and reps and Dufran and whatever else, and kind of squeeze all of the fun out of it if we can. And sometimes that leads to burnout. And so trying to get back to a little bit of fun is definitely a good insight.
Yeah, I actually completely agree with that. This is something that I struggle with, particularly with skill acquisition for people, right? Where it's like someone wants to get better at, say, gymnastic skills like muscle ups or handstand walking, or just improve their Olympic lifting and all that type of stuff. And they always want everything to be like, oh, well, I need to do this many reps of this movement, or, you know, corrective exercise. How many reps should I do? You know, okay, do I do 3 sets of 10, or should I do it every minute on the minute or whatever? And, you know, just being able to say, no, just play around with it. Like, people don't want to do that. They want to have a specific prescription for absolutely everything. And even if you give them, okay, cool, spend 5 minutes practicing hip stability and strict muscle ups, they're going to do, well, okay, cool, I'll do 4 rounds of it. You're like, no, please.
Right. Or set the clock for 5 minutes counting down. Go.
Yeah. Yeah. Please just like pretend that you're a kid, you know, trying to learn to like, I mean, I always use the example of skateboarding, because I skated growing up, and it's like, I just go on the street and practice kickflips. Like, I was just, I'd do that until I was tired, and then I'd do something different. Like, there was no structure to it.
Right. There wasn't three rounds of part A, B, and C to get that dialed in.
A1.
You know, when I was coaching at our gym, I did the kids' classes, and they were my favorite thing by far to do. And I think that largely had to do with the play aspect and kind of making fitness fun and incorporating games and stuff. So if I never really connected the dots there, I think just until just now, but I'm pretty sure that's why I enjoyed it so much.
Sure. Yeah. I think that that's a valuable trait to be able to just kind of turn it off and play and not have attachment to outcome or attachment to following a specific protocol or anything like that. I want to circle back actually to Dr. Gersmar's talk, since you guys both actually mentioned that. For people who weren't there, can you give like a brief summary of what the take-home message was from that for you guys?
Well, I think, you know, he presented a lot of interesting research up front on the influence of chemicals, and, you know, like one that might click for people is BPA. And I think he was looking at the influence of BPA in rats and the ability to, or I think the increase in weight and when subjected to BPA. I don't recall specifically the research there, but, you know, he was looking at a lot of different chemicals and exposures in people as well throughout time, and how that's influenced their ability to lose weight. It's influenced things like carbohydrate metabolism. And all of the research on the way that these toxins affect our the processes and the hormones in the body, I found really compelling. But the problem that I think I had with the talk was the sort of second half of what to do about it, I thought was a little left me wanting, because it was mostly like, okay, so then if you have these chemicals, then you need to detox. And I'm not, you know, I don't really have any science to back this up. So, you know, drink this lemonade or what have you. You know, there wasn't, I don't know, that left me wanting a little bit from that discussion.
Yeah, sure. And I think that one thing that I found interesting that he mentioned was, I guess, just the likelihood that there's differences across the population in terms of how people actually respond to that type of whatever obesogen as well, right? Where, you know, everyone is exposed to these types of chemicals and toxins at some level, right? There's obviously extreme cases where, okay, you know, this person worked in this factory and had this exposure. But that it seems, you know, based upon his talk, that some people are able to handle exposure to this with just no problems whatsoever, that the body's systems are able to process these compounds and excrete them. And yeah, maybe it's not ideal, but it's not a major issue. Whereas other people don't seem to be able to handle that quite as well. And Nicole, you actually mentioned that you know have a history of dealing with quite a few people who, you know, are experiencing symptoms that, looking back, maybe related to that type of thing. I mean, did you guys take away anything in terms of like what may separate why this bothers some people and not others?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, you know, these people are exposed to different things. And like you said, you know, we're all exposed to this crap. It's just a matter of some of us, you know, are more sensitive to it and others are not. I wonder, you know, a lot of the talks at the Ancestral Health Symposium also talked about gut flora. So maybe these individuals have a really, really poor gut flora. So they just can't, you know, detox. As well as someone that, you know, doesn't seem to have problems with these obesogens. You know, when he talked about detoxification in the discussion, you know, things like limiting exposure came up, you know, making sure that you have cruciferous vegetables and things like garlic and onions in your diet, supplements. But he also mentioned a lot about, you know, you need to urinate and you need to poop, because that's also for detoxification. So, you know, if you don't have a good gut, maybe you're not pooping or peeing or doing whatever that you're supposed to do to get rid of these things. Maybe that's a possibility.
Yeah. And Brandon, you actually mentioned being a little skeptical of detox claims, and I would put myself in a similar position. I would say that my understanding of, you know, the science on that topic and even just mechanistically how the body detoxifies stuff is soft, right? I mean, like, I have a vague understanding of different pathways and, you know, it goes through the liver and then has to be excreted or whatever, but I really don't know exactly, you know, how that stuff works. Do you have, I guess, just a, you know, an idea of like where the actual science sits as far as detoxification goes?
Well, from what I've seen, largely, I think this field is driven by alternative practitioners, right? And they're doing things that are either based on history or Eastern medicine, maybe. And not a lot of it comes from the scientific data, especially from, you know, human research. So I personally, and I think this is why I'm so skeptical in this area, is I just really haven't seen a lot of research. So that we have some base level of information on these pathways, like you mentioned, processing detoxification through the liver and excreting through, you know, through the urine or what have you. But when these areas and these, I think the question is like, can these things be compromised? And this kind of gets into the idea of why people respond differently too, is I think that the reason that some people maybe handle it better than others is that they're coming into it, exposure in a compromised state. So, you know, their ability to process and detoxify is maybe compromised because who knows what, maybe because they're doing, intense exercise all the time and eating a poor diet to match that, you know, so their body is in this state where they just can't handle it. But to circle back to your question, I really haven't seen a lot of data on this topic. And I think that's why probably both of us are skeptical in this area.
Yeah. I mean, and the other question is, you know, has research even been done on a lot of these detoxification protocols, right? Because, I mean, I think that, you know, like you mentioned, there's the normal detoxification pathway. And from a conventional medical perspective, if, you know, there's a problem there, it's like not a problem that you're going to fix by drinking lemonade and taking some supplements. Like if your detoxification is screwed up, like you're in trouble. Right. And so the question is, okay, is there potentially some sort of subclinical type of detoxification dysfunction? And A, does that even exist? B, if it does exist, how do you know that it exists? And C, if you know that it exists, can you even treat it? Right. Like have any studies even been done, even attempting to address that stuff?
I haven't seen studies on like full protocols and their ability to detoxify and like quantifying the effect. That I think most of the protocols come from something that's at a much more like a microscopic level. So as Nicole mentioned, the microbiota, you know, there might be some research that says that this specific bacteria binds well with I don't know some toxin. Let's just say BPA, right? So they'll find a bacteria that binds with BPA in a petri dish, and then somebody will then say, okay, let's extract that and turn that into a protocol, right? So there's so much complexity in the human body that there's no way that we can actually say A leads to B, but people will jump straight to that conclusion. And I think that that's where most of the protocols that we see out there today come from.
Sure. So there's some mechanistic evidence for certain aspects of these detoxification types of protocols, but no, you know, actual studies showing if person A comes in with this problem, give them this treatment, and they do better than they would have done otherwise.
Right. I've not seen that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, and this seems to be, like you mentioned, such a big part of a lot of quote-unquote alternative medicine that, you know, hopefully at some point someone actually does a legitimate trial on this type of thing to see if it's a real thing. Because I mean, you know, if it is, then there's a lot of people who probably have problems with it that need help. And if it isn't, then there's a lot of people wasting money on stuff that doesn't actually do anything.
Well, and I think that, you know, alternative medicine gets a bad rap for wasting people's money, right? But the growth of that industry now in the last 10 years or so, I'd say, is accelerating the amount of science and research that takes place. You know, we're actually putting to test all of these theories. You know, we're looking at things like the notion of adrenal fatigue and trying to see if that, you know, if that passes muster or whatever. And then we can figure out, you know, is this something that people should be investing their money into or not?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, most research has to be funded by someone, right? So
right. And well, and you know, just like strength and conditioning, I think that the way this stuff comes up and the way research gets conducted is it starts in the clinic, right? There are practitioners out there that find something out anecdotally. They, you know, they start working it in the lab or in with their patients, and then they, based on that, that body of information, that can feed into other research and, like, you know, wider studies to see if research can actually support those conclusions.
Sure. Yeah. So you guys have a company called Evidence-Based Athlete that we introed with. What's the deal with that? What do you guys do with folks? What kind of testing do you do? What does that process look like for someone who's who's interested in, you know, becoming involved in more detailed body awareness?
Yeah, so we kind of have two routes with Evidence-Based Athlete, but our overall goal is just to, you know, we want to make sure that people that come to us get a well-rounded view of their health and their wellness. You know, there's so many people that are, like, for example, super into CrossFit, and that's all they want to focus on is their training, but there's so many other aspects to their health. So what we've done is, you know, when people want to come in and figure out what they need done, they actually schedule a call with Brandon, and he sits down and talks them over the phone for about 15 minutes or so to kind of get a feel of where they're at, you know, with their training, their nutrition, their health, any health problems that they have. And we kind of triage it from there. So if someone's, you know, only interested in a training program, you know, we can certainly do that. But if someone's got, like, some gut issues or, you know, skin or something, or allergies or fatigue, you know, that's kind of a sign that maybe we need to dive more into not only their lifestyle, but maybe some functional medicine lab work as well. And kind of Brandon takes over with that based on his, he's got a background in functional diagnostic nutrition. So he can run lab work on those clients too.
Yeah, we kind of position ourselves as working with people that identify as athletes and are stalled in what they want to accomplish. And for a lot of people, you know, they get into CrossFit or they get into lifting or whatever. You know, if they're honest with themselves, they got into it because they want to look better. And oftentimes, after crushing themselves in the gym for a year, 2 years, and still not making substantial progress, they start to get frustrated and wonder, you know, why aren't they progressing? And like Nicole said, oftentimes people just want to sit there and focus on hitting, you know, using the blunt instrument of exercise without paying attention to other things like sleep and stress management and even nutrition. So when we bring people in, we have three services that we work with them on. One's program exercise program design, there's nutrition coaching, and the third's functional lab work. So that whole, the idea of that whole process in the beginning, to sit down and talk with somebody, is to sift through what their goals are, what they've done, and, you know, what I view as, like, the largest rock that's preventing them from achieving what they want to accomplish and why they've stalled out.
Sure. So you mentioned kind of triaging someone who comes in, right? So someone reaches out, and then what process do you go through to figure out what they actually need to work on, right? Because, like you mentioned, I mean, everyone's like, okay, cool, I need to train harder or whatever. And that's, you know, not always the case, especially with some competitive athletes who I work with, whether, you know, they're saying, oh, you know what, I'm not, my squat isn't as good, or, like, I feel like my conditioning isn't as good, so I need to do more work in that area. And you look at their training program and you're like, under no circumstances do you need to do more work in this area.
Right. Right.
There's something else going on here. You know, like, how do we figure that out? What does that process look like for you?
Well, you know, so I sit down and look at a few different areas. I have people submit to me what they're currently doing for exercise. So I have them submit a food log to me. They give me some impression of what their sleep looks like. So, like, how much they're sleeping, what the quality of it is. And then, how I kind of assess how stressful of a life they have. You know, if they're somebody that works 60 hours a week in some sort of high stress position, or if they, you know, have a more chilled out job, all of those things help me assess which area might be you know, the thing that's really holding them back. So, like you said, if I had some hard charging athlete come in that's looks like they've got a program that's, if anything, a little bit overtrained, and they're struggling with improving their performance, and maybe their diet is kind of there, like 50-50 there, but I see that, you know, they coach the last class at night, that, like, they coach the last class at night and they coach the next class in the morning, they're getting, you know, 5 or 6 hours of sleep and they're rating it poor quality, then I know right away that that's something that we really need to focus on. And that might not be the only thing. You know, maybe they've got hormonal issues too, because they've been charging so hard and not supporting what their body needs for such a long time. And maybe then we'll go to lab work. But I like to focus on those other areas first, because oftentimes just by, you know, taking a look at the sleep and nutrition and stuff, we can work out most of the problems. And then if something is persisting at that point, then, you know, we'll kind of dig in with the lab work.
Sure. So at some level, the people who are coming to you, you know, have raised their hands and said, hi, I need help. Like, tell me what to do. But that doesn't always mean that they want to listen. Right. Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, you may be telling people something not necessarily they don't want to hear, but that is not necessarily why they came. Right. They're thinking, oh, cool, you know, this guy is going to give me a certain macro prescription and it's going to be awesome. And you're telling them you're working a split shift and it's destroying you. Like, you can't keep that up. How do you get buy-in from people on the changes that you're asking them to make?
Yeah, that's one of the toughest parts of this job, I think. So, you know, somebody, like you said, a lot of times people will come in and they're like, oh, just tell me how many carbs, you know, how many carbs post-workout do I need? I don't care about my sleep or whatever. And then so telling them that their post-workout really doesn't matter relative to their sleep is a tough pill for them to swallow. So you kind of have to take that on a case-by-case basis, but it really comes down to understanding what the person's goals are and why, you know, what they value, you know, like where they're coming from on all of this. And if they truly want what they say they want, because if they do, and you can even show them a little bit of research that supports, like the improvement of sleep, for instance, and the effect of that on body composition or on, you know, any number of physical markers. And if they reject that, then I just have to have a frank conversation with them about whether or not they truly want what they say they want. So there's a lot of hard conversations that I have. But really, it just comes down to being able to show that person how this other thing that maybe they weren't thinking of is the real thing that's holding them back from achieving what they say they want to achieve.
Got it. And then if you have that conversation, do you see good change in terms of the actions that they're taking, or is it one of those things where you have the conversation and then it doesn't stick and then they're mad or you're mad or what do you typically see with that? Yeah.
So, and especially, you know, this happens with sleep because it feels like people are wasting their time getting sleep when they could be out there exercising more or whatever. So the thing is that I try to find the most out of the, like, so if we're going to focus on sleep, I try to look at what they're doing currently and the thing that's going to give them the quickest return so that I can get a little bit of buy-in, you know? So for sleep, if I find out that they're, I don't know, like exercising right before they go to bed, or they're using electronics right up before bed and stimulating, you know, their mind, their mind's racing before they go to bed and they can't fall asleep, then that might be something that I focus on right away. And maybe, you know, if there's somebody that's interested in body composition change, maybe they're not going to see a body composition change in a week based on, you know, taking out electronics right before bed, but they might notice that their energy improves. And since their energy is improving, they're able to work harder in their training, for instance. And so, you know, I just have to try to find, and I wish that there was some universal answer that I could give, but it's really just about picking apart the thing that is going to give them the quickest return in that area, and then just showing them the value and then building from there.
Sure. So give them like a little tactical win, right, to get them feeling good, and then create some buy-in and trust and then kind of build off of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds a little like marketing to me.
Yeah, I think it is definitely.
So you guys both have science backgrounds at some level. Give me a rundown of both of your backgrounds, because I think that's super interesting in terms of how you're approaching this sort of, you know, nebulous gray area of health, fitness, nutrition that, you know, sort of exists in without having like good, clear science in a lot of cases.
Yeah. So my background is, I have a doctorate in pharmacy. So I've been a pharmacist, a clinical pharmacist for the last 10 years. And, you know, when I got out of school, I was like a lot of healthcare professionals. I was all googly-eyed and wanting to change the world. But what I really wanted was to have a health and wellness clinic that actually keeps people from being on, you know, preventative medications or chronic medications all the time. So when I got out of school, I first went into a transplant clinic. That was really interesting. And then I became an oncology pharmacist and then kind of transitioned into diabetes care management, which was more along the lines of having, you know, a health and wellness clinic, trying to get people with their blood sugars lower so they don't need all those medications. But what I found is once we started our CrossFit gym, that was when I really felt like we actually had a health and wellness clinic. Even though I wasn't working as a pharmacist per se, I was changing people's lives way more than, you know, with my pharmacy job.
Got it. So there wasn't necessarily like a disillusionment with the practice of pharmacy. It was more so, you know, my goals are to have a more health and wellness based practice. And then you found that in fitness more so than in pharmacy.
Well, don't get me wrong. I was a little disillusioned as well. you know, it's tough. You know, as a pharmacist there, I had to go by, you know, the medical guidelines. And so, you know, if this person has this, then they need to start this medication. If their blood sugars are still high, they need to start this one. Then they add this one on. Whereas, you know, I'm thinking in my head, well, yeah, I need to get them like moving. And then, you know, let's talk about proper nutrition, because the dietitians at the hospital were telling them, oh, you know, have some orange juice or have some skim milk before bed. And I'm just hitting my head against the table. So that was definitely a challenge for me. And that was one of the perks of, you know, having our gym, whereas you could have members of your gym that trust you and respect your opinions on the matter. And, you know, you can really help them with their nutrition and their training and other aspects of their life.
Got it. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, as a pharmacist in terms of being a medical professional, you have a role, but it's not necessarily as leveraged in terms of creating long-term lifestyle change for people. It's more so helping them with an immediate problem or, in some cases almost enabling them to, you know, continue their lifestyle despite their whatever less than ideal choices.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Brandon, what about you?
Yeah. So my science background is completely outside the health and nutrition space. I, studied engineering. I have a degree in computer engineering, master's in electrical engineering, and my focus was in radar and remote sensing. So
I'm going to interrupt you and also add that at AHS, you helped me. I'm trying to write some scripts to connect various softwares that we use at the gym, and you were extremely helpful in that process. So that was good.
Super fun. Yeah, to get back to doing that, I don't have my head in that game very much anymore. So it was that was my pleasure. Anytime you get stuck, let me know.
I'm still stuck on something, so maybe I'll send you it later.
Right. Well, we can connect on that later. So yeah, I using that background, I went and took a job at NASA, working on earth science and space-based instruments for measuring a bunch of earth properties that feed into things like global warming studies. And, you know, I even got to work on the latest rover that's on Mars right now. I worked on the landing radar that got it there. So I had a lot of fun doing that. You know, I was always kind of a nerd growing up. I think it's still the same, but
is your favorite song David Bowie's Life on Mars? Yeah,
that's a pretty great one. But the thing is that as I was focusing on that job and putting in tons of hours and having lots of stress, I kind of let my health go and was feeling crummier and crummier. And that's really what got me into the health space, was trying to fix my health, and along the way seeing that there's such poor information out there. So I leveraged my research background to dig through a lot of the scientific literature on nutrition and fitness and so forth, and then drew from that to come up with the way that I live my life and that I prescribe protocols for other people.
Sure. And you know, I also have an engineering background. I have a chemical engineering degree, which I never really actually utilized. I did work as an environmental consultant before becoming involved in like health and fitness. But I think that, and Brandon and I met at a continuing education course in Scottsdale at OPEX. And, you know, I think that one of the things that we definitely share in common is, you know, a more scientific approach to understanding how and why things work, which I think is really interesting because in the fitness industry, everyone says that their approach is scientific, right? You can read any ebook and it's loaded with citations and studies and all this and that type of stuff. But from my perspective, what I think actually separates a true quote unquote scientific approach from, you know, just kind of having studies and citations and things like that is almost like an extreme sense of skepticism and self-doubt, which, you know, isn't always the best thing for marketing and getting people into the gym and, you know, taking people's money, but really being like, I think this is what works, but I'm fully prepared to admit that I'm totally wrong.
Right. Right. I'm 100% with you on the whole counterproductiveness to marketing. Like every time I write something up, I have to go back and change it, you know, 10 times because there's so many caveats and, you know, qualifications. And then you're like, no one's going to buy into this. This is the worst thing ever.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, the best way to get people to give you money is not to be like, well, we think this might work, but who knows? It's probably actually something different than what we think it is, but here's what we're selling, and you may or may not have results. Good luck. Like it's not. It's just really not the best sales pitch, unfortunately. But but you know, I do think there's a big distinction though between, again, the people who just kind of cherry pick studies. You know, I can think of a lot of very prominent fitness professionals who have a very scientific message in terms of the, you know, they're explaining mechanisms for the actions of their supplements or their protocols. They have, you know, 10 studies that show this, oh, you know, this downregulates cortisol, this upregulates testosterone, you know, you do this and you get, you know, a mammalian target of rapamycin going, and like it's just, you know, you're gonna be jacked.
mTOR that bitch.
Yeah, right. But when you actually, you know, are looking into what's really going on, you know, that all that mechanistic explanation stuff is interesting and it's cool, but a lot of the time it doesn't necessarily translate into the actual results that, you know, someone is claiming, where it's like, yes, you can take this supplement and you can get, you know, a brief spike in testosterone or whatever, but does that mean that a group taking that supplement has better results long term than a group not taking that supplement? Then the answer is almost always no.
Right. Yeah, I think there's like a fundamental misunderstanding of the way that science even works across the general population. You know, I've had this experience a number of times, and I'm sure you had as well as a gym owner. There'll be some research. The red meat stuff is probably the thing that stands out the most, where there'll be some large observational study that shows that red meat causes cancer or does something else to kill you. And then I'll get contacted from, you know, members of my gym that'll say, oh, it looks like the gig's up. I guess we're done with red meat.
Found you out.
But you know, the science is not, there's not like one study that just is like proves everything and you're done. That's it on a topic. You know, science builds on itself. And the only way that we prove things is through just iteration and building a wealth of studies on particular topics. And then, you know, maybe starting mechanistically, like you said, and then using that to build up to perhaps observational studies. And then from there, looking at randomized controlled trials, and it ebbs and it flows, and it's really complex, and it can't just be distilled down to a single study, you know, bullet pointed by a journalist and disseminated to the general population. It just, that's really the frustrating thing, I think, in the science realm for me.
Yeah, and I think that also, especially in something like health and fitness, where there's so many different variables and so many different inputs, and it's so hard to actually design a properly controlled study, that, you know, we're really just flying blind on a lot of this stuff, that the research just hasn't been done in a way that can actually tell anyone anything, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of research on certain fitness protocols, but it's all based upon, you know, leg extension machine, because that's easy to actually control for right. a study. But then can you extrapolate, okay, well, doing this type of exercise on a leg extension, can you extrapolate that to a full body movement like a squat? Like, not necessarily.
Yeah. And the complexity of the body too is just is a confounding factor. Just like you mentioned with the seeing some supplement spike testosterone or whatever, we have such a low understanding of the way that, you know, as a population, the way that hormones in particular, or just the human body even works. I think that there's a general consensus that by the layperson that we, you know, we got this thing dialed down, we understand the human body and we know how it works, but you know, we're still discovering hormones like leptin and ghrelin. They were just discovered like 15 or 20 years ago. It's all of this stuff. And you know, that we also try to take a single hormone and say, oh, like melatonin, call it the sleep hormone, right? And then just think about it in that context. But it also affects the body in so many other complex ways that we can't just say melatonin low, more melatonin good, right? Like there, it doesn't work that way.
Sure. And one of the things that I think is really interesting and challenging would be, you know, particularly the stuff that you guys do in terms of, you know, individualized program design, individualized nutrition prescription, individualized, you know, testing and lab values and all that type of stuff. You know, figuring out a way to show that that stuff actually works seems really challenging to me, right? Because say let's use an exercise example to kind of talk about this, right? Say someone comes in and their back squat is low relative to where they want it to be and where it quote unquote should be relative to their other lifts. And, you know, they have a competitive goal to hit a certain number based upon that. Right. And as someone coaching that person, you know, I can think of 7 different reasons that they may have a low back squat and 7 different ways I would attack that, right? Like one person may come in and I may, you know, based upon an assessment may decide that they actually have a stability problem, that they have a hard time actually firing the right muscles at the right time to engage properly through the movement. So I may focus their training on developing proper motor control through squatting, right? Someone else I may say has actually poor, you know, single leg strength relative to everything else that they have going on. So they may do a bunch of step ups and lunges and things like that. And I may hope that that is going to actually increase their squat. Someone else I may think just doesn't have enough exposure to squatting volume. So they may squat high reps several times a week. Someone else I may think just doesn't have enough exposure to squatting intensity. So they may do, you know, 1 rep max, build to a heavy single, build to a heavy triple a few times a week, stuff like that. And, you know, actually coming up with a way to test something like that, where you're basically giving a different prescription to each individual with the same problem. I don't know how you would actually do that.
Right. I mean, it's tough. It's not like we can run randomized controlled trials with our clients. So all we can do is what Nicole said is triage. You know, we bring a client in and let's say we're going to work with them on their squat. Well, you know, the only way that we can work with them on their squat is to start with an assessment. And so we'll have them submit videos to us, and maybe through those videos, we can determine that it's perhaps one of those, it's the stability problem, or maybe through our intake form, we'll assess that they're pretty new to squatting and they really haven't had much exposure to it. So maybe it's just a volume thing and we'll work on that. You know, and at the end of the day, though, it's still a guess. You know, we can't say that we're giving them the right answer. All we can do is say that we're giving them our best guess. And if they're improving, then and they're happy with it, like if they're improving relative to how they were improving before and they're happy with it, then, you know, who cares if they have the quote unquote best prescription, right? As long as they're continuing to make progress toward their goal, I think that's the ideal.
Sure. So in terms of talking about all this, you know, science and prescriptions and all that type of stuff, what steps do you guys take in terms of your own prescriptions and results and all that type of stuff to try to avoid bias, right? To try to avoid common, you know, whatever, attribution errors in terms of why things are working?
That's it's a really tough problem. So mostly it's really just about not getting caught up in specific protocols, you know, to using that assessment data to developing a prescription based on that, and then to measuring, you know, because if you are seeing changes in the person, it's true. There could be confounders, right? Like I could give them a squat program and maybe I don't know it, but they're sleeping more and that's why their squat's going up, you know? I can't have all the answers on that. All I can do is sit down and give a prescription, an educated prescription, and then measure and iterate based on that and just try to develop my ability to put together better and better prescriptions over time and also continue, you know, the self-education process and expanding my horizons. That's really what it's all about. But again, coming down to the poor marketing end of things, you know, there's just no unique or universal prescription for anything. Everything is based on the individual. And so all we do is try to do the best we can assessing and then measuring and iterating.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the confounding variables thing is really interesting, right? Where you mentioned the sleeping thing, you know, I mean, I've had clients who I'm like, I'm pretty sure you started doing steroids. like there's nothing, you know, yeah, I think that my program I gave you is pretty good and like whatever, but there's no reason that you should have, you know, set a 40-pound PR on everything in the last 2 months. Like, well, or maybe, you know, whatever. It just happens sometimes. Who knows?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, the best you can do for that sort of stuff is just continued contact with the individual, which is one of the reasons why we really like the individualized training and nutrition, you know, working with clients one-on-one, is because you have that closer contact. So you can just gauge those things a little bit better. You can have conversations with people. When you're running a gym with a bunch of people, it's much more difficult to dig that deep with each person.
So I think that we're all at some level information collector type of people, right? Especially since we all spent some time at AHS. That's probably the target market is people who collect information. what do you guys do in terms of, you know, trying to educate yourselves, stay up to date? What does that process look like for you guys?
Yeah, I'm definitely a hoarder when it comes to information. So, you know, the first step is just continuing education and getting exposure through different courses and areas that are compelling to me. And, you know, that's how you and I met, for instance. You mentioned meeting at OPEX. So I really enjoyed their training. You've had James on your show, and he's a fascinating guy to listen to, and he's opened the door for me to a bunch of different avenues. Like, I wouldn't have even gone into the functional lab space had I not gone to OPEX and listen to Mike Caselli give his nutrition talk and then hear him afterwards talking about working with people on their labs like he does. So, you know, I like to start with continuing education and then use that to find the little rabbit holes that I'm going to go down. And the rabbit holes are mostly, you know, they might start with some sort of research online through website sort of stuff, but ultimately they end in the scientific literature and just digging through and spending way too many hours in PubMed looking through research, you know?
Is that what, do you predominantly use PubMed for actually looking up research studies?
I do, as much as I can. You know, there's other stuff like the strength and conditioning related papers. You know, there are other sources for those, but largely it's PubMed. And Nicole actually has a couple subscriptions, I guess, to other websites where we can get papers because of the whole.
That's always a challenge.
Yeah, that's one of the tough things is you'll read something, it'll seem interesting, you'll try to track down the paper, and it won't be available.
Yeah, you can't get it. All you get is an abstract. That's not.
Yeah. And then there, you know, there's a challenge right there in people interpreting abstracts without reading the full paper too, right? So, and that's mostly what happens. So, you know, the best that we can, we just try to track down those papers and see if they actually say what maybe the interpretation that we saw that led us to them, you know, claimed. And then I like to store all that stuff, you know, from a practical sense, I store all that stuff and tag it in Evernote. And then it's always available and easily searchable.
So you have what, just Evernote files, and you can type in what, like, how do you actually tag stuff?
Yeah, so I'll do things like, so I'll have one tag that might be like scientific papers. So that'll let me search just all the papers that I've done if I want to go back and track that down. And then I tend to tag based on So I might tag based on disease condition or something like that. So if I've been studying hyperglycemia, I'll have all the papers that are hyperglycemia related, they'll be tagged scientific paper and hyperglycemia. And then that'll allow me, if I do those two tags and then search some topic within that I am trying to dig into, you know, Evernote works super well. And that's kind of my scheme working with it. It's all tag based.
And do you, what do you use, like the Evernote web clipper to actually save the stuff to Evernote, yeah, or how does that work?
Okay. Yeah. Usually I use the web clipper to, drop everything in. Sometimes it malfunctions though. So I'm in the desktop app every day because I tend to just clip things throughout the week. And then once a week go through those go into like an inbox folder for me. And then I go through and process all of them at that point. And so I don't have to think about processing them in the moment. And then that's when I do all the tagging. And even if I'm not going to, you know, a lot of times I just use it to grab papers or resources on topics that I know I'll be interested in the future. I just don't have time to deal with right now. And so, you know, I just amass this huge collection of stuff that is available. And when I'm ready to get into a topic, then I've got it already for me. I don't need to, you know, start from ground zero.
Cool. So you basically clip it and then store it and then read it when you're actually digging into a specific topic.
Right.
Interesting. What about highlighting? Do you do highlighting or note-taking or anything like that on the papers, or you just kind of have them?
Yeah, I do. If there's something that really stands out to me and I want to come back to, if I take the time to read through a paper, then I'll tend to highlight and even take a couple of notes on them so that I can – it's a lot easier than, you know, you got like some 10-page scientific paper and they're pretty dense usually. So it's nice to have just a little description and maybe a couple of bullet points within the note so that I know what information's in there, and I can quickly, if I need to go back through the paper, maybe I'll know exactly what section to go into, so I don't have to waste however much time it would take to read the whole paper over again.
Sure. And then journal articles are, you know, relatively challenging, at least from my perspective, to sort of find as far as like, okay, what do I actually want to know? Like, is this quality research, all that type of stuff? Do you have any sort of filtering mechanism or source that guides you to good journal articles, or is it just kind of searching for specific terms on PubMed or any of those other sites that you mentioned?
It's tough. You know, oftentimes I'll start on a topic by browsing websites and interpretation of literature. So, you know, I've over time developed people that I grow to trust, and I won't say that I trust them completely, because, you know, I keep a healthy dose of skepticism in anybody's interpretation of research. But I'll sort of use that and those people's starting point as a jumping off point for myself. So, you know, for instance, Chris Kresser puts out a lot of great information on the functional lab space that we play in. So oftentimes if I'm curious on a topic, like just go back to hyperglycemia as an example, he's got a lot of articles on his website, hyperglycemia. So I'll go there, and he often quotes references. I'll start with those references, and then I'll use that as the thing that starts me down the rabbit trail. So I'll read all those papers, and then based on my curiosities in that field, then start doing, you know, independent PubMed searches and look up more, you know, in the areas that I felt were deficient in the papers that I read, or just new avenues that I want to explore.
Got it.
Because it's hard. It is hard, like you say, it's hard to go from scratch, just like PubMed search, you know, search field, hyperglycemia, type that in, and it's like you're
inundated. It's just like, yeah. Oh my God. I use Google Scholar a lot for stuff like that too. And you know, sometimes you find something very helpful, and other times you're just like, do I really want to, you know, scroll through 10 pages of search results to try to find what I'm actually looking for?
Well, it's
it almost reminds me of when like search engines were somewhat new.
Right.
Like if anyone remembers when, like, you know, before Google's algorithms are super dialed and you're like on Lycos and you're like,
that's what I was just going to say. I'm on Alta Vista right now searching and I just can't find it.
Yeah. Like I looking for research, I kind of feel like that sometimes, where it's like there's no, I feel like the information isn't filtered in a way that's necessarily helpful. It's just kind of like, here's a list of 100 things, like, good luck.
I think that's another area that's probably primed for improval over the next, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, and also access to research, which
completely is
very limited right now. I think that's going to keep getting better and better. So yeah, I don't think it's going to be as hard coming up.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the business model for that type of thing is going to have to change at some point away from that sort of like institutional pricing that sort of locks out,
right.
You know, independent users or people who are running small businesses or things like that who actually want to look at the research but don't have the budget of a university to actually get the, you know, database subscription or whatever.
Right. And it's a really interesting question, too, because a lot of the research is funded by the government, by our tax, you know, our tax money. But then the journal publishes it and puts it behind the paywall. Right. So, you know, we actually funded most of the research that's out there, but we just don't have access to it because the journals are sort of the gatekeepers on that.
Yeah. And especially with the way that, you know, internet content and internet marketing and things like that have kind of evolved over time to be very much, I don't know, like free based in the sense that a lot of it is used to generate clicks or ad views or honestly just opt-ins to various other services. That at some point I feel like some of those journals have to figure out that they can make their content free and then utilize that effectively to have some sort of other business model other than right. just like kind of a brutal paywall. So it's not even like, oh, pay $5 for the article. Like,
no, it's like, always like yeah. pay $50 for this article and you don't even know if it's going to be what you want.
Right. Exactly.
So yeah, I think that's even changing. The other day I was introduced to a website called ResearchGate. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've utilized that. It's pretty good. It's not perfect in terms of what you can access, but I don't think anything is. But I've definitely gone through some stuff on there and had a good experience.
Yeah. So I think it's just a sign of things to come, and it's going to keep getting better.
Yeah, completely. So, Nicole, after Brandon's extensive systematized information consumption process, I mean, what about yourself? I mean, you have a more formal schooling background in this type of stuff. What about you? How do you actually go through information and try to, you know, learn stuff and keep track of it?
Well, with my pharmacist license, I do have to do, you know, a certain number of hours of CE. But that's pretty much, you know, just like medical, not really in the nutrition and health space. So that type of thing, I'm not nearly as organized as Brandon. I don't do Evernote. I like to write things down on paper. I'm pretty old school. But I love to do that and just kind of dig down a rabbit hole of, you know, I'll follow certain people on Instagram, like Brett Contreras, who's otherwise known as the glute guy. He does a ton of research on glutes. But, you know, what's the best way to activate the glutes for, you know, for athletic potential, or, you know, are squats better or hip thrusts better and things like that. So I really like to dig in on that type of thing. And then in terms of like disease states and stuff like that, UpToDate is probably my favorite site. And again,
I'm unfamiliar with that. I'll have to make a note.
Yeah. I think you might have to pay for it. So
yeah, that's an expensive one.
I have a pharmacy hookup for that. But it's awesome because you can type in like any disease state and it'll come up with a million articles and then a bunch of references to, you know, tons and tons of papers on it. And you can just really dig in, you know, as far as you want to go.
That sounds potentially very helpful.
I think, you know, Nicole and I are very complementary in this sense, where I'm extremely data driven and sort of obsessively organized, and she's a little more free-flowing, and I think that's our sort of complementary you know, personality types at play.
Sure.
I think Brandon's the guy that, you know, is all about the numbers and the research behind it, whereas I'm the one that just wants to hold the client's hand and make them feel really good about it. And, you know, they get a lot better if they feel that they have a connection with their coach, or, you know, that, you know, we can dive in together on what's really their issue, as opposed to, you know, the science on the other side, but maybe, you know, what's in their head and what's going on with that.
Got it. What about continuing education resources? I mean, Brandon, we already discussed OPEX. You mentioned Chris Kresser, and I know you're involved in some of the training that he's put on. What else have you guys found particularly valuable in terms of either strength and conditioning or, you know, functional medicine or anything like that in the continuing education space?
I don't know. I have a hard time with a lot of the continuing education, because I think that courses in particular tend to be dogmatic. And
sure. It's like, here's my method. It works for everyone. Please use it.
Exactly. And I really struggle with that. OPEX is sort of an exception in that field. And it's both good and bad, because I think you go in there and you get all of these things dumped on you, and there's no real, like, here's how you use this. It's just like, here's a ton of information that's going to keep you busy for the next 10 years of your life. I like to do things that are more open-ended like that, things that will lead me to my own train of research. And so I tend to gravitate away from continuing education, like formal courses. You know, there are some, I continue to do them, but I like more to maybe find researchers that are putting out, are pursuing topics that I find compelling. You know, like Nicole mentioned, Brett Contreras as an example, or, you know, Brad Schoenfield. Just those guys, you can follow them and see the research that they're putting out. I just prefer to come at it from that angle and then interpret that research and, you know, put it into play how I see fit and not follow somebody's ABC prescription.
Got it. Yeah. And I think that that's something I experienced too, where, you know, I'll go to stuff where it's like, okay, cool, this is the, you know, the ABC protocol. And you'll be like, well, I don't like that, but there is this one little aspect that I think is really, really valuable. And then it's sort of on you to be able to extract the value from it and utilize it without just trying to blindly follow someone else's system.
Right. I think that, I mean, that's a solid point. Anytime going into those, it's what can I take away from this? I don't necessarily need to walk away. You know, it's not an all or nothing thing. And just like you were saying with coming up with squat protocols, you're going to get some piece of information that's going to help you with that squat protocol, but each person comes in with a unique set of circumstances, and it's incumbent upon the coach to know what thing applies to them. So getting, like, increasing the size of your toolbox and the tools that you have available is something that I'm, you know, in constant pursuit of.
For sure. What about you, Nicole? Any particular continuing education that you found valuable?
Actually, I've kind of been doing some interesting stuff lately with my own training, and I'm kind of viewing that as a form of continuing education.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, if you feel something new, then you can be like, oh, that feels different than I expected.
Exactly. So, like, you know, prior to this past year, I was all about, you know, improving my potential and, you know, possibly competing. And, you know, I had specific goals for myself. But as of this last year, I've kind of decided, you know what, that's not as important to me anymore. I still want to be healthy. I still want to be fit and improve, but I really like trying new things. And, you know, maybe I'll try some protocol or program for 3 or 4 months, see how I respond to it. You know, what did I like about it? What did I not like about it? What type of clients do I have that would benefit from this specific, you know, combination within the program? And so I've been doing a lot of that kind of as a form of continuing education. So, you know, instead of doing your standard CrossFit type stuff, for a while I was doing, you know, 4 months of bodybuilding protocols, not because I wanted to be a bodybuilder, but because I wanted to learn by doing some of that stuff and take that for my own clients.
Sure. And with, you know, experimenting with different protocols, are you hiring coaches who sort of specialize in that area, or just kind of, you know, trying it yourself, or what does that look like?
Yeah, well, Brandon was actually my coach up until this last year. But after that, I've just kind of, you know, taken bits and pieces of different protocols, like, you know, a bodybuilding protocol that I think from RP Strength. I was like, you know what, I want to try this for 4 months and see, you know, how I respond to it. And, you know, I had some elbow issues. Maybe some of that accessory work would really help my elbow, which it did. And then, you know, moving on from there, writing down everything I learned from it and bits and pieces that would work well for my clients, other parts that maybe wouldn't work well. And then moving on to, you know, something that's maybe a little bit more CrossFit based or metabolic conditioning based, and taking bits and pieces from that and just learning as I go so that I can implement that with others.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. Would you say that you now, based upon the bodybuilding stuff, that you live for the pump?
Totally. Oh my God. My biceps grew like exponentially. It's crazy.
That's cool. It's good. It's important. And then, Brandon, you mentioned something that I thought was really interesting and that I agree with a lot is that, you know, you try to find sources that you roughly trust. You don't necessarily believe everything that they say, but, you know, there's an element of trust there. How do you, you know, decide that you, quote unquote, trust someone? And do you do anything to find sources that disagree with those that you agree with?
Yeah, I always want to keep an eye, a healthy dose of skepticism and look at research and interpretation of research, maybe to a lesser extent, of conflicting data from my sort of thought, you know, train of thought at the moment. So trying to find people that you trust mostly is challenging because oftentimes people are motivated by, you know, financial, whatever course they have or whatever, you know, party line they've been toting for so long. But eventually, after starting out by being 100% skeptic on somebody, I'll start reading their material. If it seems compelling and not just like total BS, which you can usually suss out pretty quickly, I will go back and look through some of the research that they're quoting and see if the conclusions that they're drawing are warranted or if, again, they're just kind of bending research to their will. And also, I'll look to see if any of the people that I've developed trust with thus far, you know, are reference them or show some level of respect online for them. And that kind of gives them a little bit more cred in my mind. But it's a slow process to build that trust, and it can be erased very quickly.
Sure. And you mentioned Chris Kresser as someone who, you know, you have that level of trust for. Is there anyone else in particular?
I
no one.
No, I do. I do. So I sort of compartmentalize it a little bit too, you know, like Chris Kresser, I'm looking at everything that he's putting out in the functional medicine space. I'm paying less attention to what he's saying in the physical training space, right? Like he's been out there and he said some things about exercise, and it's not necessarily that I disagree with it, but the clients that he's, the population that he's talking to are not the population, you know, it's a different population that I'm working.
It's not his quote unquote lane, right?
Right, right. So when I'm looking at training and, you know, I have a great deal of trust and respect for what they do at OPEX and James Fitzgerald and the other guys there. So I take a lot of, I have a lot of trust in the information they put out on training. In the sort of hypertrophy space, I like what Brad Schoenfeld puts out. I think that's relevant, but again, like the other day, I can't even remember the research now, but there was some paper that came out on gluten, and it was talking about how basically everybody's okay with it. And, you know, gluten's a real sort of dicey topic, and I think both sides of the spectrum take things a little far. But, you know, this research comes out, and then he uses it as just like, see, if you, like, haven't had gluten, then you're just waste, like you're doing yourself a disservice or whatever. It's I guess kind of out of his lane too. So I try to, the takeaway is I try to find people that are doing good stuff in a particular area and just focus on listening to them in that area. And if they talk about stuff outside of that, I ignore them.
It's reasonable. It's a very reasonable approach. So for you guys then, you have evidence-based athlete where people can get some programming done, they can get some functional lab work done, they can have nutrition prescription, lifestyle consultation, probably get told some stuff that they don't want to hear. What is that? We talked about what that intake process looks like, but if someone is interested in kind of going down some rabbit holes, what do they actually do?
Yeah, so like with the lab testing, for instance, you know, if somebody comes in and it looks clear that lab testing is the route that they need to go, especially with the crowd that we talk to, which is mostly fitness people, the hormone test is usually where we start. And so we do the Dutch hormone test, and it uses urine samples. So we send a kit out to people, and they pee on a piece of paper, four pieces of paper, and let it dry. And then they mail that back to the lab. The lab does the processing, sends me the results. And from that, I can take a look at a handful of things. I can look at their cortisol and cortisone daily patterns. I can look at how they're metabolizing cortisol. I can look at this, the whole sex hormone pathway, see how they're metabolizing everything from cholesterol down to end products like the estrogens and the testosterone. And it allows us to get a comprehensive view as to what's happening. You know, the thing that we're really trying to do here is not put on the band-aids like Nicole's talking about in pharmacy. Sometimes we're just enabling people to live bad lifestyles. And oftentimes in medicine, they might do something like look at testosterone and see that it's low and then prescribe hormone replacement therapy. And that might not be the best course of action. You know, there may be something happening upstream from testosterone in that sex hormone pathway that's just not getting evaluated. So in with this test, it allows us to look at the whole, the bigger picture and try to fix any sort of underlying causes as opposed to, you know, endpoint symptoms. And if people want to do that, it's really easy because this test they can do at home. The results get done, get computed in about 2 weeks. And then I have a consult with them, walk through the results and tell them how that their symptoms might be related to some of the things that I'm finding in the lab results, and then develop a protocol and work with them over a series of months to correct things. And oftentimes the things that they've got to do to correct them are just like you said, the things they don't want to do. You know, it's really about managing their stress and getting better sleep. And sometimes there's some supplements that we got to do, but that's usually like the last topic to hit on.
Everyone always wants the suppies.
Yeah. It's the killer thing. They're like, nah, screw the sleep. I just, you know, give me whatever melatonin.
Give me my pre-workout.
Yeah. My pre-workout. That's it. That's where you get the pump, man. But that's pretty much how it works doing the hormone testing and everything else that we do is, you know, the nutrition coaching and the program design. It's pretty similar. It's all hands-on. We work very closely with our people. And that's what we like to do and why we've gone to this one-on-one model is because we just, you know, it resonates better with us to have that sort of deeper impact.
And I have a question for you on the testing as well, since this is another area of skepticism for me, is, you know, as someone who's curious and likes to do stuff, you know, I've done all kinds of testing and like, sure, man, like, yeah, take my blood, test this hormone, like you want me to pee in this, like, awesome, I'll do it, whatever. And, you know, one of the questions that I have on a lot of testing stuff is, you know, what is the actual reliability of the test and does it actually tell you anything, right? Like if the same person does the same test, will they get at least, you know, comparable, reliable results? And then is there any action that you can take based upon the test that you know is going to cause a certain result? What are your thoughts on that relative to the testing that you do?
Yeah, I think that a healthy dose of skepticism is warranted. And it's also the reason that we have this intake process up front, because I like to, you know, work on the lifestyle stuff before even getting to the lab work. And if oftentimes that kind of clears things up and we don't have to even go down the testing rabbit hole, you know, the go with that route. But a lot of this alternative testing does get a bad rap. And especially if you look at something like the saliva hormone testing, and I've actually done a fair amount of that over time and I have had mixed results with it. And I've seen studies where they'll compare, you know, from lab to lab, the same sample, doing split samples and get vastly different results. And so that's why I backed off doing the saliva testing. And every bit of research that I've seen on the urine testing shows a great deal more of consistency. But how do I know that what we're doing is actually affecting things? It's all about the data. We test and we retest. So if I see something like a disrupted cortisol pattern, and I also see in their intake that they're, you know, having trouble sleeping, they're waking up with a racing heart rate, then I have a symptom that correlates with that data, and then we make an intervention, and then we either retest or monitor that symptom. And if we see improvements, then we're good to go, right? Like that's the whole objective. They came to me in the first place to resolve a problem, not necessarily move a result. But if we move the result, it helps prove that what we're doing is actually doing something, I guess.
Sure. So you can speak to the intention of the treatment and why it was done and what the result was, but that doesn't necessarily mean that what actually happened is what you think happened.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said,
same thing with the program design. It's like, cool, I'm going to improve your squat with some single leg work and speed work and whatever. Your squat got better. And like, I know why I gave you that stuff, but that doesn't mean that's why your squat got better.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're up against things like the placebo effect as well. So if we give somebody some intervention, we have no way of knowing if it was that intervention or if it was their perception of that intervention. But like I said, I don't think none of that really matters. What matters is that they're getting better.
Absolutely. And Brandon, you also participate in audio content on the internet. What's the deal with your podcast?
I ask myself that same question all the time. So I have a podcast called Strength and Scotch. We've been doing it for, we're coming up on 100 episodes now. And I do the show with my buddy Grant. He's somebody that I met through my gym. And he's always challenging me on health and fitness topics. And we're kind of debating things and just going into weird corners of the health and fitness world. So we thought it'd be fun to record a little podcast about it and see what happens. And, you know, my job would be the nerd scientist part and his job would be the honk the horn and dick joke guy. And, and you know, for the most part, we've adhered to that. But we did find out in the beginning that since I'm such an introverted person, it was very challenging. So we ended up adding some booze to the equation. And that's how the scotch got into Strength and Scotch.
Are you drunk right now?
No, that's, I think, why I'm a little bit dry in this in my speech right now is because I've had no booze to lubricate things.
Got it.
But, you know, your podcast is a lot more detailed and goes, you know, really gets into some deep topics. And I think we try to be a little more surface level and just try to make the concepts of health and fitness approachable and fun and, you know, convince. Basically what we're trying to do is try to convince people to sleep more. And we do that by just getting drunk and being stupid.
Yeah. I mean, as a Strength and Scotch listener, I will say that from my perspective, it is a funny show with good content.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know if I agree, but I appreciate it.
Oh, come on, man. Market yourself. This is not the time for...
I don't know how to do that.
Awesome. So, yeah, if people are interested, they can check out evidencebasedathlete.com. And then Strength and Scotch exists in...
Yeah, there's strengthandscotch.com, or they can get it on iTunes or wherever they get there.
You got to use Overcast. Everyone needs to get on the Overcast train. Yeah. That thing is awesome.
I agree 100%.
You can have variable playback speed. So, you know, 1.5 for me is too slow. 2x is too fast. Overcast lets you go somewhere in the middle. If you donate, there's actually an uploads feature. So if you're a psycho like me and like rip audio files of lectures and things like that, you can upload your own files.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's really, really good.
That 1.7 to 1.8, I think that's the sweet spot for playback speed.
I agree.
I agree with you.
I agree. Depends on the podcast or the reader of an audiobook, but that's about right for me.
Right.
So yeah, basically, Evidence-Based Athlete, Strength and Scotch, Overcast. These are the things that everyone needs to check out.
Absolutely.
Guys, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Todd.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been fun.
So, since you made it to the end of this podcast, I'm assuming that you liked it. I'm going to hit you with a little pitch, one that you've likely heard before, which is to head to the iTunes store and hit that subscribe button. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review if you think we deserve it. The reason you hear that pitch so often is iTunes uses ratings and those subscriptions to create its charts. And those charts actually have a significant impact on how many people discover new podcasts like this one. Obviously, content creators want more people to listen to their stuff. And the reason for that could be many different things. Maybe they have some sponsors that care about the number of downloads per month. Or maybe they have some additional information that they sell on top of their free podcasts that you listen to on a weekly basis. Now, what's in it for you? Well, for me personally, I listen to a lot of different podcasts, and I need to prioritize the information that I'm listening to. Some are more entertainment-driven, while others are more informational or even language learning podcasts. Subscribing to these podcasts keeps me updated on the newest episodes. It makes it easier for me to pick what I want to listen to when I'm on the go. If you want to actually hear what we have to say on a monthly or even bi-monthly basis, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. That way, we all win.